It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Congress has been trying, and so far failing, to pass immigration reform over the past months in the midst of high numbers of border crossings and asylum requests. But this lack of movement on the issue of immigration is nothing new. It's been going on for years. There was a failed attempt at reform under President George W. Bush in 2006, another in 2013 led by the bipartisan Gang of Eight in Congress, and more in between. Our next guest says that we're in a particularly challenging political moment, but immigration reform has always been difficult in the United States, stretching back at least to World War II. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What changes do you want to see in U.S. immigration policy, if any? Do you see the core issue as a humanitarian crisis, illegal border crossings and security, something else? Is there a compromise that you'd like to see? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Daniel Tischner is professor of political science and faculty director of the Wayne Morris Center for Law and Politics at the University of Oregon. He recently published an article on the challenges of immigration reform in The Conversation. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
In just a moment, we'll dig through some of the history going back to World War II. But Dan, you say this year right now, meaningful reform in immigration is a pipe dream. What is particularly bad about early 2024 when it comes to the prospects of changes in our immigration system?
The obvious thing is it's very hard to achieve immigration reform during a presidential election year. And in this year in particular, clearly the Republican ticket's headed by former President Donald Trump, who has signaled to his loyalists in Congress that he really wants to have this stick as a campaign issue. Also, a time when things are really polarized in, between the parties in Congress. So you mentioned before in your intro about 2006 and 2013 as being challenges. There you had bipartisan compromise. And right now, just the divide between the parties is like a chasm.
Let's go back and trace some of the history that got us here. In that piece I mentioned in The Conversation, you start in the aftermath of World War II, a sense, I think, that something needed to change. But it took a couple decades to do it. Set the scene for us.
Yeah. I mean, at the time, you had in place something called national origins quotas, which really imposed severe restrictions on all kinds of illegal immigration into the country. And in particular, it placed a real privilege for those from Northern Western Europe. And so anyone from Asia, Africa, Southern Eastern European countries like Italy, Greece, and elsewhere were really restricted by these draconian barriers. And once we get after World War II, the United States emerges as this global superpower, feels an obligation towards refugees. But again, these really tough, stringent limitations kept us from being as expansive as a lot of policymakers on both sides of the aisle wanted to. Really, immigration was almost a trickle most of those years. And yet it kept on being held up. And at the heart of that was just stiff resistance from these kind of very restriction-minded committee chairs in Congress. And so it just kind of languished for years and years. And so you had President Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, a Democrat and a Republican, both trying to get something through, and it went nowhere. And it really wasn't until John F. Kennedy made this a signature campaign issue in his 1960 election that it gained real agenda support from the White House. Following his assassination, Lyndon Johnson actually hemmed and hawed about doing anything about it. He wasn't sure if he wanted to invest a lot of political capital on that issue. He saw it as kind of a political minefield for him and other Democrats. And eventually he was persuaded. And even after that, kind of faced all sorts of resistance, both in the House and Senate. And so it was only after a lot of arm twisting and a lot of deal making that we finally got in 1965, the Immigration and Nationality Act, which created a new preference system for legal immigration and increased the number of admissions. And also, as a concession to restriction-minded folks in Congress, created a Western Hemisphere ceiling, which actually spurred a fair amount of undocumented immigration. So that was one of those kind of Faustian bargains or bipartisan bargains, but it took decades.
Then we're going to fast forward a couple more decades. 1986, which people point to as the last major significant change when it comes to our immigration laws in the United States. Again, 1986, good long while ago. Tell us a little bit about the politics that led to that, the agreement that was reached and what it meant and how it set the stage for our modern immigration system.
Sure. So that one was also decades in the making. And, you know, early 70s, mid 70s, you had actually liberals in Congress, Congressman Peter Rodino from New Jersey, a number of organized labor folks who really wanted to see us enact something called employer sanctions, which was the notion that you can, as a nation, we ought to impose sanctions, civil and criminal, against employers who knowingly hired unauthorized immigrants. That encountered resistance both from the left and right for years, because on the right, there was a lot of resistance to imposing these regulations on employers. And on the left, you had liberals concerned that these kind of sanctions would create discrimination at the workplace against anyone who looked or sounded foreign. So fast forward to the Carter years. Carter tries to make an initiative, ends up exploding on him. It doesn't go anywhere. Reagan comes into office, and he's quite reluctant about it. But eventually, in 1986, you had, again, one of these bipartisan deals that was cut. And it included employer sanctions, which I mentioned a moment ago. It also included a legalization program for roughly 3 million undocumented immigrants living in the country, enhanced Border Patrol resources and other security measures, and then finally a guest worker program. So it had these four elements to it. And you might note that there's some contradictions between them, which is kind of, you know, at the heart of these kind of compromises, which it cuts in both pro-immigrant and restrictionist directions oftentimes.
Talking to Daniel Tischner from the University of Oregon. He researches immigration policy and its history in the United States. We're pulling back from the day-to-day arguments about immigration, getting some historical perspective here. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or your thoughts. That's 800-642-1234. Dan, having been alive through a lot of the last bunch of rounds of immigration efforts, and been in the media for part of it, it seems like there's a recurring, almost constant argument that we're in some form of crisis, especially at the southern border. Is there some reality to that? How much of that notion is politicized?
I think there's definite reality to it in the sense that we have seen kind of record numbers of asylum seekers at the border in December and January and so forth. And there is a sense that policymakers on both sides of the aisle see that there's some chaos there that needs to be addressed. At the same time, you know, it's not uncommon for politicians to, to exaggerate this. And so it's probably a bit of both. I think is the short answer. I think most Americans, looking writ large, looking more broadly at the immigration system, would say that it is broken in key ways. And that's both folks who are pro-immigrant rights and those who worry about porous borders. So on both ends of the spectrum, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the system and feeling like it's not working the way it should. And that runs everything from concerns that we're not addressing our biggest needs in terms of legal immigration, to those who feel like we do need to shore up border security, to those who point out that we have more than 10 million undocumented people living in the country who are kind of in the shadows of American life. So there's a host of things that you can point to as challenges in the system. And actually, that kind of goes to the heart of why we're often stuck on immigration reform, because a lot of Americans and a lot of lawmakers can't even agree exactly what the problem is.
Has the nature of people coming across the southern border changed? It seems like once upon a time, the mode case is somebody trying to avoid detection crossing the border in order to seek employment, as you mentioned, in the shadows. With asylum seekers, it seems like the goal is to present at some point and make an asylum request. First of all, am I right about that change? And second, does that change the nature of the problem we're dealing with?
Yeah, I mean, you're right that exactly, you know, for years, the notion was that your unauthorized immigrant was trying to evade detection and slip into the country. And in the current mode, if you're an asylum seeker, you may have, you know, hundreds, thousands who are actually seeking out Border Patrol agents to have their cases heard and to be legally allowed in. So I mean, that's definitely a change. The other thing I would note is that as a change at what's happening in the southern border is that, you know, for generations, the typical entrant from across the Mexican border, U.S.-Mexican border, was Mexican. And today, a significant portion are actually coming from other countries in Central and South America.
Daniel Tischner is with us, professor of political science at the University of Oregon. He's talking with us about why immigration reform has been historically difficult in the U.S., in Congress in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Immigration reform, our guest says, unlikely to happen in election year. What immigration policies do you want to see the next president, the next Congress put into place? Do you think about immigration policy when you're deciding who to vote for? Have you experienced the U.S. immigration system as an immigrant, as an asylum seeker yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about why immigration reform has historically been so difficult to achieve in the U.S. Our guest is Daniel Tischner, professor of political science at the University of Oregon. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history of immigration and immigration policies in the United States? Why do you think it's such a difficult issue to reach agreement on in Congress? Do you see room for bipartisan compromise? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. John is with us in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, I'm old enough to remember the Reform Act of 1965. It was pushed through by Senator Edward Kennedy, the deceased president's brother. And they got it through because they finally persuaded the unions that there was not going to be a danger of them losing strength by the dilution of the workforce and thus wages. The liberal wing of the Democrat Party was in the process of taking over the unions totally, and they told the unions that the additional number of low-wage, unskilled, uneducated people flooding the country would be beneficial because it would bring more Democrat votes. And that's what it's been about ever since.
John, thanks for the call. First of all, the issue, Dan, of immigrants' impact on wages and on labor unions, that has been a point of contention over the decades, right?
Absolutely. And John's totally right about how that was a key sticking point for the 65 Act. And what's really interesting is how union leadership and the AFL-CIO has evolved on this issue. So for most of our history, unions have been very much concerned about the capacity of immigrant labor to undermine working conditions, wages, make it very hard for collective bargaining. And so I mentioned several minutes ago something called the National Origins Quota System, which was kind of this very draconian restrictionist system we had for much of the 20th century. And the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, was a key moving force behind that. So, yeah, so all that, you know, created lots of tensions for union members for years. After the 65 Act, what's interesting is that you had, again, organized labor very concerned about undocumented immigration and competition from immigrant workers. But then that begins to evolve during the 1980s. And so by the time of the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act, the AFL-CIO was strongly in favor of a legalization program for 3 million immigrants in the country, wanted employer sanctions, and so wanted better workplace control, but was starting to focus on really intently on A, holding employers accountable, and B, seeing immigrant workers as individuals who native-born workers should be in solidarity with. And so by the time we get to the 20th century, the SEIU and other key unions were actively recruiting among these new immigrant workers, such that today you can find the AFL-CIO and most unions squarely behind immigrant rights in lots of key ways.
And then John alluded to something that's been viewed almost as a conspiracy theory, but some Republicans arguing that Democrats are in favor of more immigration reform to bring in more Democratic voters. How much of a sticking point is that? Is that notion, at least, Dan, to prevent Republicans from reaching compromises on immigration?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because it's actually not a sure thing in terms of party identification with regard to new immigrants about where they'll fall. And if you look at immigrants, first of all, our immigrants are so diverse. They come from so many different backgrounds. They have different kinds of social, economic, and political values that fall on a wide spectrum of conservative and liberal lines. So, and what's also interesting on in that regard is that, since we're doing a little bit of a historical dive this afternoon, is that if you look at someone like Ronald Reagan, Reagan regularly invoked the notion that the United States was a city upon a hill and waxed very, very romantically about immigrants as being, you know, fundamental to the national identity. And in a more practical sense, he and his aides looked at new immigrants as critical to building a new Republican majority. So how quickly things shift on that, right? And so, yeah, so we've kind of evolved to a moment when key leaders in the Republican Party, in fact, as you say, you know, focus on the notion that, you know, that immigrants are being, you know, crassly recruited to replace native-born voters and so forth. The evidence is actually that things are quite slow in terms of once immigrants get here, in terms of registering to vote and so forth. And what's interesting, again, is, you know, Reagan and George W. Bush saw those voters as very much good candidates to recruit to the Republican Party as well. Is it the key sticking point? Good question. There's a lot of things that divide Republican and Democratic members of Congress on this. What's striking is it wasn't that long ago when it would be very hard to predict exactly where a Democrat or Republican in Congress might fall on this issue.
Thanks, John, for calling. Bob is with us now in Kaukauna. Bob, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering when the Republicans had the House, Senate, and presidency in 2017, did they do anything with the immigration policy?
A good question, Dan.
No, I mean, I think it was, the answer is no. I mean, what's striking is that you obviously had significant unilateral executive action. So the so-called, you know, effort to restrict migration from predominantly Arab and Muslim countries, the so-called Muslim ban. But there actually was not a significant amount of agreement in terms of what to do specifically on a number of longer lasting immigration policies in terms of legislation. And so, For instance, the Trump administration, along with Senator Tom Cotton in the Senate, had plans to significantly restrict legal immigration, but that was not popular with a significant portion of the Republican Party in either the House or the Senate at the time. That was actually kind of considered dead on arrival.
Bob, thanks for the call. And just our last minute, Dan, how much does congressional inaction on immigration exacerbate the problems at the border?
It exacerbates it in a lot of ways. First, it clearly empowers the executive to act really, you know, independently without any sort of congressional oversight on this. And the problem with that is then, you know, it basically means that we don't have continuity in how our immigration system is governed, because it switches every time we switch parties controlling the White House. It also ends up devolving a lot of things at the state level, as we've seen, where we have, you know, border states, governors taking certain actions. And finally, it brings the courts in. So almost every component of our governing system is involved with this, except those decision makers who are empowered by the Constitution to make these choices, which is Congress.
Dan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Daniel Tischner, professor of political science and faculty director of the Wayne Morris Center for Law and Politics at the University of Oregon. He talked to us today about his recent article in The Conversation. The headline, "Immigration Reform Has Always Been Tough and Rarely Happens in Election Years." I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. Department of Agriculture released its latest Census of Agriculture last week. That report is a collection of updated data on the state of farming over a five-year span from 2017 to 2022, broken down by each state. The newest agricultural census showed that overall the number of farms in Wisconsin continued to decline. The state is seeing an increase in new farmers, though, who tended to be younger on average. The census data touches on crops, livestock, land use, energy, economic production, and more. We're going to dig into those numbers with the help of a Wisconsin agricultural economist, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the state of farming in Wisconsin? Are you seeing a loss of farms in your area? Is the use of farmland changing in your community? If you work in farming yourself, or maybe have recently left that line of work, you're not alone if so. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Steve Deller is a UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist and a professor in agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the studio.
Good afternoon.
All right, before we went on the air, you used the word alarmed when it came to the number of farms in Wisconsin.
We knew that we were losing farms, but at this rate was somewhat shocking. In 2017, we had 64,800 farms. In 2022, we had 58,500 farms. That's just less than a 10% drop in the number of farms. That's a really big drop.
And it follows an ongoing trend, right? We've had this conversation before, the number of farms going down, but getting faster, the disappearance of farms?
It ebbs and flows. I had thought that the decline would not be nearly this much. I thought we'd be looking at less than a 5% decline. So this almost 9.7% decline is kind of caught me off guard.
Now, when I look at livestock, obviously people think about dairy in Wisconsin, hogs and other things. It seems like another conversation we've had in the past, those large operations getting bigger and more of them. What's going on at that end of the spectrum?
That's another sector that we lost a fair number. Again, in 2017, we had just over 9,000 dairy farms or farms with milking cows. In 2022, it dropped to 6,200. That's a 31% decline. Now, if you look at the number of cows, milking cows, that was there was also a decline, but it was a much more modest, I mean, small single-digit decline. So you have fewer dairy farms, about the same number of cows. So the average size has increased. In 2017, the typical or the average dairy farm had 141 cows. Now it's up to 203 cows. So the herd size is getting bigger. And as you mentioned, part of that is the growth in the really larger farms.
Yeah, talk a little more about that. As I looked at the cattle numbers and especially the hog numbers, as I was looking at that, I'm trying to do the math in my head as I'm reading these charts. It seems like the biggest ones are getting bigger and bigger. What we used to think of as a big, say, hog farm would be medium now.
It's the economics is driving them towards scale. But you have to keep this in perspective. Mm-hmm. I was just at a conference in California and talking about the size of the farms out there. A small dairy farm out there is 25,000 head. There's nothing that comes even close to that in Wisconsin. So a big dairy farm here would be, 10,000 head. But we are seeing a growth in those larger farms, and it's because the economics is simply driving it that way.
All right. What does it mean for a rural community if instead of having a bunch of small to medium-sized, say, dairy farms, there's maybe one or two large-scale dairy farms?
Well, there's two ways to look at this. One is simply kind of the amount of income that's being generated on those farms. From a purely economic perspective, if you're looking at 10 farms that are struggling to survive or one large farm that actually pays halfway decently, the local economy is actually better off with that larger farm, because there's more money for the workers and the family to be spending in the local economy. But recall, though, that a lot of these smaller farms, the vast majority of the farm family income comes from off-farm sources. So we got to remember that relationship.
Now, you mentioned the market driving people to concentrate, to get bigger. How much of it is the market versus are there policies, federal government policies, say, that militate toward larger operations?
The federal policies do favor the larger operation simply because we have this we've had this policy almost since the Great Depression of cheap food. So when you look at federal policy, it's really trying to maintain cheap food and stability in the farm sector. And it's that stability that a lot of the policies are aimed at trying to introduce. The problem, though, is that for the farmer to take full advantage of those programs, you got to have some size. You got to have some scale. So they don't set up the programs to benefit the bigger farms. It's just the nature of the beast. If you're a bigger farm, you're in a better position to take advantage of these programs.
Talking to Steve Deller, UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist and professor at UW-Madison, looking at this big report, a 5-year report on trends in agriculture in the United States, including Wisconsin. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Farmers love to hear from you. Or if you've left the business or cut back and counted more on off-farm income, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We focused on livestock so far, Steve. When it comes to crops, does anything stood out to you so far as you go through these numbers?
The amount of harvested cropland also dropped. It dropped by almost 474,000 acres. That's a pretty big drop, but that's a 5.1% drop in harvested acres. However, if you look at the size of irrigated acres, that actually went up. That went up by 21,000 acres, or about 4.6%. And if you can think of Wisconsin, picture Wisconsin, you've got the Central Sands where there's a lot of vegetables grown, potatoes grown, and whatnot. That's irrigated land. We're seeing an increase in that. But the kind of the traditional corn and soybean type land, we're seeing a slow decline in that as well.
Why is that?
I think it's profit margins. When you look at, if I can grow vegetables, I can make a little bit more money than if I'm growing corn and soybeans. So if I'm making a long-term investment, the decision is I'm going to go to the crop that I can make a little bit more money on. And that's in Wisconsin, that tends to be vegetables, including potatoes.
One thing we've talked about in the past, Steve, is kind of a hollowing out of the middle-sized farms. So we get these bigger ones getting bigger, but maybe some room for those smaller ones with the boutique thing. Maybe it's vegetables or a value-added good or something unique and maybe something particularly local. Are we seeing that in these new numbers?
No. And that was one of the things that surprised me is because, as we've discussed before, there's kind of a hollowing out. It's the growth in the bigger farms and growth in the smaller farms going towards local foods, specialty crops, specialty products. But we've also seen a decline in the number of small farms. And we need to dig into the numbers a little bit deeper to try to figure out why that is. Is it that the markets have shifted? Is it that the movement towards local foods is not growing as much as it was? Is it still a lingering effect of COVID? We haven't dug into the numbers deep enough to really answer that.
Yeah, one thing I was wondering about is we had some food inflation. Consumers noticed that after COVID. Now, these numbers are coming from 2022, so we don't have that 2023 year of high food inflation there. But I get callers saying, hey, we used to do that organic. Food prices are higher. We're going to conventional produce. We're not buying that stuff that maybe that smaller operator would count on. I mean, could that be part of the story
that
here?
That could be. It also remember, during COVID, how many restaurants shut down and how many restaurants were unable to come back online? How many of those restaurants were sourcing local foods? When you get into, you know, markets like, say, the Madison market, it is a real marketing component of a restaurant to say, hey, the chicken that you just ordered came from Barbara Jones's farm down the street. That's a marketing component. A lot of those restaurants, they're just now starting to come back. So part of this is the lingering effect of COVID. But that's a hypothesis.
Sure. Now, Tom from Green Bay couldn't stay on the line. He was wondering how much small farmers are diversifying their crops and whether that's helping. Well, I could see that going a couple of ways, Steve. What do you think?
Well, it depends on how you define a small farmer. Mm-hmm. If you look at the hops industry in Wisconsin, there's a growing hops industry, but a lot of these farmers, you're talking 1 acre. So is that a viable farm? We can get into that. So I think that some of the smaller farms are actually viable enterprises, I think that they are trying to diversify as much as they can because that's a good business strategy.
Talking to UW-Madison Agricultural Economics Professor Steve Deller about the new Census of Agriculture, what it says about the state of farming in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about the declining number of farms in Wisconsin with large-scale farming and livestock operations in the state? Are you one of the newer farmers getting into the industry? We'll look at those numbers in just a bit. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Steve Deller, UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist, professor in Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. We're looking at the latest Census of Agriculture data on farming in Wisconsin, showing an overall decrease in the number of farms. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the state of farming in Wisconsin or maybe a personal experience as a farmer or former farmer? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring on a caller. Monique is with us in Plainfield. Monique, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the show today. It's very interesting.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Monique?
I wanted to ask a question specifically about how we're defining vegetable farming. So I'm from the Central Sands area, and we do have a lot of potatoes, which are technically defined as a vegetable, but now so many more of the potatoes are grown for potato chips. I think that's the vast majority of the potato crop that's grown in this area now is for potato chips. Hmm. Is that still defined as a vegetable?
Monique, thanks for the call. Now, Steve, if you're coming to my potluck and I assign vegetable and you bring potato chips, I'm not going to be happy. But if you're doing an agricultural census, yes, right?
It is. It's a vegetable. And a tomato is technically a fruit. So it's, yeah, unfortunately it is. Now, one thing you have to remember, this is the census of agriculture. We're looking at on-farm production. But when you look at the importance of agriculture to the state of Wisconsin, the big impact is food processing. Mm-hmm. Where the real impact is making the cheese. And processing those vegetables. The concern, one of the concerns is that if we continue to see a decline in the number of farms and the value of the amount of produce that's being produced or crops being produced or product being produced, that suddenly our food processors start to have a hard time, then we got serious problems.
Thanks for that call, Monique. Patty is with us in Manitowoc. Patty, hi.
Yes, hi. I'm very pro-agriculture. I live in the country, and it's one large semi after another spreading liquid manure. I'm very concerned about water contamination. Would you share, please? Thank you.
Patty, thanks for the call. And we see controversies as people open, by Wisconsin standards, very large livestock operations. What happens to the manure? How big an issue has this been, Steve?
This can be, well, it depends on what part of the state you're in, mm-hmm. because the geography of the state is some places you can actually spread manure and it's kind of processed into the ground efficiently. There are other parts of the state where it goes straight into the water table. So it depends on what part of the state you're in. I think that most farms are very aware of their environmental implications. And I think if you grab a typical farmer, they would view themselves as an environmentalist, and they want to do the right thing. But you do have accidents. You do have an occasional farmer that is, makes a mistake or is sloppy, and, you can have really negative consequences of that. But I think your typical farmer is, really conscious and wants to do the right thing. Because they live here, too. I mean, they live here. Their kids go to school here. They drink the water here. They take stewardship of the land pretty seriously.
Thanks a lot for that call. Steve, another number that I've mentioned, what looks like an increase in the number of newer, younger farmers getting into the profession. I know that's been a concern. Succession planning, who's going to take over the farm as people retire if their kids don't. Do you see this as a significant data point in this report?
This is something that I want to dig into a little bit deeper. I was just doing some work with some colleagues at Penn State University looking at women farmers, and the growth in women farmers is actually quite remarkable. And they tend to be coming in on smaller specialty scale type farms, feeding into local foods, feeding into organic. They tend to be smaller scale. But I haven't, that's something that I want to dig into as well. The thing is that if you want to get into farming, it's very difficult to get into large scale unless you inherit, unless you're taking over the family farm. If you are not from a family farm and you want to get into farming, it's a very expensive proposition.
Right. It's capital intensive. You need big, high-tech equipment.
You need big tech. And, I mean, if you want to get in starting as a dairy farmer, you need at least $1 million. And you're 30 years old. You go into a bank and you go, I'd like to start a farm. And I've went to school. I've got the experience. I internship. I worked on a dairy farm. And the banker goes, okay, how much money do you need? I need $1 million. What do you think the banker's going to do? The state is trying to help with that. But that's a big hurdle. So a lot of these younger farmers are getting into the smaller scale with the idea that they're going to ramp it up over time.
Back to our callers now with Don in Milwaukee. Don, hi.
Good afternoon, sir.
What did you want to bring
Thanks
up, Don?
Thanks for having me. Well, my question is the reality that more foreign nations are purchasing farmland or property in the U.S., how do those numbers affect the fact that the small farmers have to work so hard just to make it?
That's a bit of a I think it's a little blown out of proportion, the amount of foreign investment in agriculture. You do have some foreign investors that are looking at Wisconsin or looking at agriculture in the U.S. as like they would any other investment. And they see, a large poultry farm that may make sense from an investment perspective. You are seeing increasingly non-farm families or rural families that are making these kind of investments from a purely business. It's a good investment. I'm going to invest in it. But I think the amount of foreign investment is probably more of a political talking point than what's actually happening.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Steve Deller, agricultural economist at UW-Madison, looking at a big new census of agricultural information in Wisconsin and around the country. Steve, the report also talks about, the income. How are farmers actually making money by farming? There's a final bottom line number, but I assume this is a case where an average probably conceals more than it tells us. As you look at this report, what do you see about the economic well-being of people in farming?
They're doing better, but there's two components to that. One is some of these farmers are getting bigger, and as they get bigger, the economics are in their favor. They're going to do a little bit better. But also, the past couple of years has actually been pretty good in terms of commodity prices. So the past couple of years have been kind of good years. It's actually expected that this year, the 2024, commodity prices will be coming down a little bit. Still historically good, but so you have to look at these kind of revenue numbers kind of almost on a year-to-year basis, depending on what's happening to commodity prices. For example, if milk prices are really high, dairy farmers are doing pretty good. If milk prices are really low, dairy farmers are bleeding money, and it ebbs and flows.
And it can be a double-edged sword. If the commodities I'm selling are high, great. If the commodities I'm buying, the feed that I need to feed the livestock, say, that's going to hurt me. I mean, is this kind of biting people on both ends here a little bit?
Yeah, and this is where the economics kind of favors the larger farms, because the larger farms are in a position to better contract out these things and minimize those fluctuations. If I'm a farm and I'm buying $1 million in feed, I can write a contract that essentially locks that in. Whereas if I'm a smaller farmer and I'm buying feed on a monthly basis, I'm more at the mercy of what's happening to those prices. So this kind of going up in scale to larger farms, not only are you in a better position to take advantage of federal programs, but you're better positioned to minimize risk. And that's the economics that's driving larger farms.
Now, the data from this census is from 2022. What are you watching for right now, Steve, and what's happened since then and what's coming in the next couple of years, just in our last minute or so?
I'm thinking that this is the timing of this census is a lingering effect of COVID. And I'm thinking that these 10% drop in the number of farms is a COVID effect. So I'm hoping that when we start to get more current estimates, not a census, but estimates, that these numbers start to look a little bit better. That's what I'm hoping.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Steve Deller is a UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist and a professor in Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. He joined us today for a look at the latest data on farms in Wisconsin found in the USDA's new Census of Agriculture that was released last week. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, monarch butterflies are a common sight in Wisconsin, but they face serious challenges with threats to habitats along their migration routes. We'll get the latest on efforts to protect monarch butterflies. You can join that conversation coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. And by the way, we are limiting our winter member drive later this month to one day, just one day. You could help us meet our fundraising goal and unlock an extra $20,000 for the WPR programs you value by making a gift now. Get ahead of the game. When 500 people donate before that one-day drive on February 28th, we'll meet that challenge. You can join in now. Do it at WPR.org/donate. Some bonus info from the new Census of American Agriculture. A Wisconsin researcher used the data to go county by county to see which domesticated animal was most common, including humans. This comes from John Johnson at Marquette University. Here's what he found. Humans are number one in almost 1,500 counties nationwide. But in 757 counties, cattle outnumber people. Here in Wisconsin, humans are number one in most counties. Cattle has around 15 counties just ahead of chickens. There's a turkey zone in four counties in northwest Wisconsin. The standout for me nationwide in one county, the most common animal is the chukar. The what? I had to look it up. It's a bird like a partridge. It's the number one animal in one county in Pennsylvania. I assume there's a story there. All told, quoting Johnson Online, humans are outnumbered by one single kind of livestock in 1,658 counties. I, for one, welcome our livestock overlords. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll explore treatment options for opioid addiction and find out why many people face barriers to getting that treatment. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a delivery driver, an icy driveway, and a comedy of errors.
There's an old saying about the Postal Service. Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night, etc., etc. But if you're a driver delivering a package in the winter to the Lake Halley home of writer Patty C., well, good luck with that.
In Lake Halley, last Valentine's Day, it was a balmy 41 degrees and rainy. When I left for work, I was hopeful the many layers of packed snow on my steep quarter-mile driveway would melt. Instead, it became a bobsled run. Then an Amazon van and its rescue tow both got stuck. When I arrive home, I park at the top of the driveway and start my trek down towards the idling flatbed tow truck. I watch the driver wrap a long strap, looks like a slack fire hose, around a tree. Flatbed man says, I can't get any traction, so I'm winching myself up. Then we'll get a smaller truck down here for the Amazon van. Amazon guy gets out of his vehicle when he sees me. I am so sorry this happened, I say as a greeting. The same thing I just told flatbed man. Our driveway is legendary among delivery drivers. This one tells me he saw our package drop-off tote at the top of the driveway, but he says when I braked, I slid past it and couldn't back up. How long have you been here, I ask. Just a few hours. I'm getting paid to wait. After my husband Bruce and I eat a quick dinner, I put together a care package for Amazon guy. Bottle of water, ginger ale, sleeve of Ritz crackers, Kind bars, banana. Really, Bruce says as he watches me rifle through our pantry. This from someone who once coaxed a lost delivery driver into the house when his car spun out halfway up our driveway. Bruce often calls our isolated driveway Donner Pass, the California mountain feature named after the family who perished trying to cross the Sierra Nevadas winter of 1846. Unlike for those doomed travelers, there will be no cannibalism in this vegetarian's yard. Bruce served that Domino's driver a sandwich and chatted with him at our kitchen counter until the kid's dad arrived with a pickup and a tow rope. Amazon guy accepts my snack through his open window. The passenger seat is filled nearly to the roof with envelopes and boxes, which means some disappointed sweethearts on this Valentine's night. He reports a new plan. Once flatbed man is out of the way, dispatch will send a four-wheel drive vehicle for the packages and Amazon guy. Nobody knows the slow going of a flatbed tow truck being winched uphill from tree to tree except the guy connecting the strap to the next trunk in an icy rain and getting pulled a measly 36 inches at a time up a driveway over 600 feet long. After waiting here 4 hours, the last two spent watching a rescue vehicle, Amazon guy exits his van with a headlamp strapped to his forehead. He tells me he's walking up the driveway and someone will pick him up. I can't even offer to drive him since the flatbed is still in the way. Any customers who track their packages will see them stalled next to Lake Halley until morning. It'll be at least another hour until Flatbed Man makes it to the top. Amazon guy is wearing better gear than anyone in the Donner Party. Their wagon train got stuck in snowy, rugged terrain. Eventually, they ate their oxen hide snowshoes. When Amazon guy lifts one foot to show me his ice cleats, he falls into the snowbank. How many times can I apologize? How about one more?
Patty C. is a writer from Lake Halley, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org, on Facebook, and on Instagram. I'm Brad Colbert.
You're listening to Central Time. Effective, evidence-based treatment for opioid addiction is out there, but many people experiencing addiction aren't able to access it. A study released last year found that in 2021, only 1 out of 5 adults with opioid use disorder received medications to treat it. An addiction and public health expert is with us now to guide us through treatment options for opioid addiction and the barriers standing in the way of medication-assisted treatment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one ever struggled with opioid use disorder? Were you able to get help? What does recovery look like for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar is an associate professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW-Madison. She's a core faculty member in the UW Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program and acts as the medical director of harm reduction services for Wisconsin's Department of Health Services Division of Public Health. Dr. Salisbury Afshar, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Before we get into treatment, what is the current state of the opioid problem here in the United States?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And I think, unfortunately, as we probably have all continued to see in the news, we continue to see really high rates of drug overdose. We've seen some shifts over time. The vast majority of overdoses in this country continue to involve opioids, but we are seeing involvement of other substances as well. And as we're going to talk about today, we've seen significant expansion in treatment, but we continue to have some barriers and limitations in terms of supporting people to get treatment, and also in really thinking about making sure that treatment services are super patient-centered and creating services that people want to engage with.
Some people might think about opioid addiction and think it's, you know, once you have it, you're stuck with it forever. But as you were just saying, there are treatments, there are effective treatments. What are those? What do we know as far as the best options for people dealing with addiction to opioids?
Sure. So we talk a lot about medication treatments when we talk about treatment for opioid use disorder, because while behavioral treatments and behavioral therapies definitely exist and should be available to anybody who's struggling with an opioid use disorder, we know that medications are really, really important. And when we compare, we look at big groups of people, research studies and real world studies, when we look at people who are accessing one of the three medications that's available and compare it to folks who who aren't using any medication or maybe are only engaging in behavioral therapies, we see that folks who use medication have better outcomes. They're more likely to stay engaged in treatment. They're less likely to use non-prescribed opioids. And then in the case of two of those medications, methadone and buprenorphine, they're less likely to die of overdose. And so it's one of the reasons that when we talk about opioid use, we always want to talk about medication, because really the medication treatments are considered first line. And then if people are able and willing, we want to make sure that they're also accessing behavioral therapies.
Now, there's a mindset issue. Some forms of addiction treatment in the past have said you shouldn't use a medication because you're just replacing one addiction with another. And I think that kind of thinking has affected laws and regulations when it comes to things like methadone. How big a problem is that to overcome, to say, no, this is, in fact, the best line of treatment we have?
Absolutely. It's a great question. So I think at the federal level, research is so clear at this point that the medication treatments have the best outcomes, and there has been a lot of money and attention and focus on increasing access. There are a few barriers, and one of them is regulatory. Methadone in particular probably has the strongest, strictest regulations of any medication we have available in this country. And most of that is historical. So when methadone was first promoted as a treatment, actually the original methadone studies were done among people who had criminal legal involvement. And so it was offered as both a treatment, but also specifically sort of in this criminal legal environment. And as methadone became more available, what we saw is that there were just tons and tons of federal regulations. So if I, as a family doctor, I'm allowed to prescribe methadone for pain in a clinic setting, but cannot prescribe methadone for opioid use disorder. The current federal regulations say that methadone can only be administered at a specially licensed and highly regulated clinic called an opioid treatment program, or what people often refer to as a methadone program. And those laws that were set back in the 70s are still in existence today. This is not consistent with what's done in other countries. It's not what's done in Western Europe. It's not what's done in Canada or Australia. And so there is a big push right now to move the U.S. into a regulatory environment that would look more like other high-income countries, to be able to increase access to methadone outside of the current structures that are available.
If somebody wants to access methadone, how geographically available is it? Are people having to go a long way just to get this treatment?
It depends where you live, right? Not surprisingly. And so we'll typically see that there are opioid treatment programs available in the bigger cities across the state. But definitely as you get into more rural areas, access can become more limited. Because these are federally licensed and state monitored clinics, there are really accurate lists of opioid treatment programs available, both through the state and also through the county behavioral health offices. They'll have a good sense of which programs are available in individual communities. I should also acknowledge that there has been, honestly, partly because of COVID, some new allowances, one of those being that there's now an allowance for mobile methadone. So to be able to, sort of put an opioid treatment program on wheels, so to speak. And I know that there's a big push across the state to get more mobile methadone into communities that might otherwise not have access. And so we are seeing a bit more of that.
Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury-Afshar is an associate professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW-Madison. We're talking to her about effective treatment options for opioid use disorder and the barriers that many patients face when seeking treatment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story to share that you're willing to share, yourself or a loved one, of dealing with some opioid use disorder, of seeking treatment, finding it, or having trouble finding it, we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you are a healthcare provider or first responder, what are you seeing? What kind of access do people have to treatment? What frustrates you about the difficulties in getting people to treatment? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our conversation with Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar, Associate Professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW-Madison. We are talking with her about medication treatment for opioid use disorder and what's preventing more people from being able to access it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story to share about seeking medication treatment for opioid use disorder, finding it, or having trouble getting to it, love to hear from healthcare providers as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jacob is with us in Eau Claire. Jacob, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Jacob?
Well, I've been hearing about I've been sober for 15 years now, kind of off and on with the Suboxone, given how, the situation in my life and what goes on. Sometimes I have to be on it and other times I don't. I'm just wondering, there's a shot out there for Suboxone, and I'm just wondering why it's not as available or advertised as the other treatments.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Suboxone is the brand name of a drug you mentioned earlier, Dr. Salisbury Afshar, buprenorphine. Can you talk about Jacob's question there about getting these monthly shots?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jacob. I think, you know, sometimes when medications are newer, it can take a little bit of time for them to get sort of the same level of press, publicity, or awareness. And so there are actually now two different formulations of an injection that people can get that has the same active ingredient, buprenorphine. Suboxone's the name of the film, the trade name sort of the film that people are often prescribed. And then Sublocade and Brixadi are the name of the injectable forms of buprenorphine. You know, I have to be honest, Brixadi is the newest, and I actually don't have access to it in my own clinic right now. The other medication, Sublocade, has been around now for a number of years, 3 or 4 years. I'd have to look back at exactly when it came onto the market. Because they are controlled substances, one of the reasons that it's a bit slower is that there are just extra processes around even getting them into the clinic. We can't, for example, order it through a normal pharmacy. It has to come from a specialty pharmacy. It has to get delivered directly to the clinic. It can be quite dangerous if someone were to inject it into a vein, for example. So it's a medication that's only approved to be administered by healthcare professionals who have completed a special REMS training course. So there are a few extra pieces to it, but you know, really great medication, especially for folks who maybe, you know, struggle with remembering to take a medication every day, or, you know, just find it easier to have a monthly, or Brixadi can also be weekly injection. So for folks who really want sort of a longer acting medicine, can be a really great option.
Thanks for that call, Jacob, at 800-642-1234. Kyle joins us now in Baraboo. Kyle, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I worked in the mental health realm for quite about a decade now. I used to be a probation and parole agent. And, you know, I've referred people to Suboxone clinics or Suboxone treatment who were tied up in the correction realm of things. But it seems like the availability and the attainability, like the speaker was just talking about how some doctors aren't trained in it, is leading to like kind of a lack of resource for it. I mean, it's a great medication, but it's hard to find in the rural counties such as Sauk County or any of those outlying very smaller counties. And so what are some of the barriers that need to be addressed to be able to make it more accessible for folks in across Wisconsin and also just across the nation?
Kyle, thanks for the call. Great question. And Elizabeth, you mentioned some efforts to have mobile providers. Are there other things you could see helping? Maybe when it comes to licensing more health professionals, or I don't know what.
Yeah, it's an ongoing challenge, and I want to first start by just acknowledging I do think things have gotten better over the past decade, but as just brought up, clearly we still have a long way to go. you know, for buprenorphine, which doesn't have the same regulations around it that methadone does. So buprenorphine can be prescribed in an office-based setting. We used to have a bunch of regulations around having this special license and requiring some special education. All of those were actually removed in the last couple of years. So some of those regulatory barriers are no longer in place. I think one of the challenges that I see, particularly in rural areas, though, is that it's not just that there's a shortage of prescribers to prescribe buprenorphine. It's that there's often just a shortage of healthcare providers in general. We're seeing primary care shortages across the country, and definitely not a ton of behavioral health providers specifically in rural areas because, you know, patient volumes are smaller. Ways to address this, I think we have major workforce issues across, and I'm actually from rural Illinois, which I know isn't always a popular thing to say in Wisconsin, but it's like the way southern part of Illinois. And so my brother and sister-in-law work in a critical access network hospital there. So I mean, I'm really familiar with the challenges that rural areas face in terms of recruiting and retaining healthcare professionals. I think that's an important piece that we can't overlook. There are also major reimbursement challenges as it relates to, you know, we don't have parity, meaning behavioral health care isn't reimbursed in the same ways that physical health care is. And then in particular, we see that a lot of we see overrepresentation of people who need substance use disorder treatment within the Medicaid population or public payer population. And Medicaid reimbursement rates are really, really low. So essentially what we're talking about is going into a community and saying, look, guys, we know you don't have enough prescribers. We know that you're really struggling to keep up with primary care volumes, but now we want you to learn a whole new skill set. We're going to pay you very poorly for it. And, you know, we know that you're sort of drowning just with the patient volumes you already have. Like, it's a hard sell. And I've definitely met docs and prescribers in rural communities who are like, Elizabeth, look, I want to do this work, but we just don't have enough people to do all the things I've already been trained to do. And now you want me to train to learn something new or to learn a new skill set. And I just don't feel like I have capacity. And so I think it's not just one thing. Stigma is there. And so I don't mean to say that's never the problem, but I think it's not stigma alone. It's stigma, it's reimbursement, it's the workforce challenges across the board as all things we need to continue to work on to really continue to expand access to these evidence-based treatments, including buprenorphine.
Kyle, thanks for the call. We just have less than a minute left. Elizabeth, for someone who's dealing with opioid use disorder and saying, yeah, I would love to have this kind of treatment, how do they start? How do they get the ball rolling?
You know, I wish I had like a really straightforward answer that was 100% accurate every time. I think the two places I always encourage people to start are 211. So the statewide 211 system is really working to build out accurate information on where people can get substance use disorder treatment. The other place, a lot of the services in the state are really county-based. So look up the county that the person is residing in and that behavioral health division. And I do this in my hospital work. If I'm working with somebody from a county that I'm not as familiar with, I call the county behavioral health office and I say, okay, I'm working with somebody who really wants to access, you know, fill in the blank, buprenorphine treatment, for example. Can you tell me who are the prescribers in your county? Where are they located? And I start there. And that can be a really important place to start. And if you have insurance information, unfortunately, like we all know, that often dictates where people can go. So just figuring out sort of which places take which insurance.
We'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury-Afshar, Associate Professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW-Madison, Medical Director of Harm Reduction Services for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services Division of Public Health. She joined us for a look at medication treatment for opioid addiction. Again, a starting point, 211 if you're trying to find treatment in your area. Tomorrow on Central Time, a neuroscientist digs into the nuts and bolts of memory and how we can tune our brains to remember the important stuff with the new book, Why Remember, that Central Time.